You're listening to Dissident Radio. Be safe crossing the road.
Has anyone got an electric guitar? No, it's a really fucking stupid question. No, never mind. Right, as I said before, or any of you who didn't hear the first time, my name's Al Baker, and I've been writing songs for about 3 years now. And now I'm here playing for all you lovely people. So thanks very much for asking me. And I'm going to sing one of the very first songs I ever wrote. And it's about... Oh, it's always about a girl. It's always about a girl. The song's called... And a haircut. It's called Sometimes I Wish I Had a Mohawk. I'm the kind of a guy who gets stuck in the back room of parties with a beer in my fist raised half to my lips as I give out some free evening classes on philosophy and politics and where the world's gone wrong. More or less I make it up as I go along. Then I sing the old red flag and get the words wrong. You're the kind of a girl who wants a husband, a kid and a Mercedes. If I'm a Guardian reading, sometimes quite disturbing, but my crossword skills are amazing. They say you really don't care about the wider world, and you like your men to treat you like a little princess girl. But I know you never took the telegraph that seriously either. And sometimes I wish I had a mohawk. Some people expect what they get when I talk. And sometimes I wish I had a magic mirror. If beauty isn't skin deep, where is it, I wonder? And I'm the kind of guy who uses humor as one of his defenses. And if I wait for you for a year or two, then maybe you'll come to your senses. I don't need a girl who's politically sound. I just want a best friend who will stay around to laugh at my jokes and take pity on my various offences. And sometimes I wish I had a mohawk, but my hair just doesn't grow that way. So I'll let you imagine it, say I love you, and I hope you say it back to me someday. I'm the kind of a guy who thinks that we should be together, but I detest writing love songs that go on too long, and this thing has gone on forever. You said you love me for my politics, my passion and my fire. Believe me, I can do that on whatever you require. I ain't gonna change for you, I don't think I can. But you be my mohawk and I'll be your man.
Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
What date's today?
It's the 1st of September.
Yay.
Yay. And we're still at climate camp. And it's been great. Very windy today, right?
Yeah, totally. The Radio Shack, which was late in coming up, is starting to fall apart. I was just actually thinking how marquee is like life. The marquees are like life in general.
Yeah.
So the conception of getting one, the conception of ordering is really exciting. And you order it, you choose the size, and you say, I want one with a pointy roof, or I want a roundy one. And you choose, you know, it's a bit like life, you choose to have something. So you have a conceptual moment, and then it arrives, and it's really, really hard work getting it up, as it were. And that's really, really crap. And then the longer, it's really great for the first while, and the longer you have it, it just starts dilapidating and sagging.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, that's totally happening to
just
us now.
Just takes the knocks of life, right? You know, the wind, the rain, the sun, the good
like
times,
the rest
the
of
bad
us.
Times.
Again, following my analogy here. And but unlike life, when we're tired of it, we're just going to rip it down.
Which will be fairly soon. But absolutely. It's been fun to be here, that's for sure.
Totally. Loads of love on site, and it's been a really, really positive, good place to be.
Yeah, loads and loads of hard work has been done by many, many people to make this happen, and definitely big up yourselves out there for getting involved. And
we don't have a list, and for fear of missing people, you know who you are. But who have we got on tonight's show, dude?
Well, we just heard, by the way, a track from Alan the Dole Q, who played last night in the main marquee, and that was a good tune. from last night. Ollie's going to be talking to us about all stuff related to land movements and
the significance of this field, though.
Yes, essentially, because there is a very good reason why this particular area was chosen. And he goes into great detail about that and about some of the history as well. We'll hear a track from the Interterrestrials because they kick ass and...
We love them.
Yeah, exactly. And Derek Wall is going to be giving us some why anti-capitalist sort of spiel. And I think that's important because that is a large element of the criticism that's coming out of this camp of the sort of financial system that we're... currently experiencing.
Being anti-capitalist or being a critique of capitalism, that type of thing?
Yeah, essentially. And Lynn Soya is going to be talking about animal rights and some of the things we can learn from the recent police repression and of that particular part of the very large movement, I suppose, that many people think that this is included in. And we're also supposed to have some live guests in.
Hopefully.
Yeah, we're hoping that they might be even listening and coming in to tell us about the really exciting actions that happened today. And yay, Theo Bard just arrived.
We're
backing
band.
I'll admit, we've totally played his music on our regular show, Dissident Island Radio. And he's in with a fiddle and an accordion player, Beth. That is very, very exciting.
Look forward to that, sir.
And we'll hear from the media team as well, who are going to tell us about more about what happened today and, you know, let us know. Because there's loads of stuff that has happened, and many people left site very early this morning to get active and on the streets.
I missed that. I don't know about you.
Yeah, well, I was up, but...
cool. So, well, let's rock into the first interview.
Yeah.
And we'll hear from Ollie.
Yeah.
Sitting here with Ollie, and we're going to talk about... land-related things. So, first off, what's so special about the place that we are in? What are people referring to when they say the Peasants' Revolt? And, yeah, what's the significance historically of this site that we're in? Can you give us some information on that?
Okay, well, I think there's a number of reasons why we're here on Blackheath. The first one is that... when you come through the gate, we've got an amazing banner saying capitalism is crisis, and underneath the banner is a view of the three biggest towers of Canary Wharf, two of which are HSBC and Citibank, and I think that that symbolism of our comment that capitalism is crisis and those banks who've done so much damage to the world and to people all over the world is an amazing thing, and it's because this year the climate camp is targeting capitalism and its relationship to the climate crisis, and here's one of the best places in London to look down on the city and to give us a view of them and to hold them in our minds as one of the main reasons why why the climate and the planet has been destroyed at such a pace and the people that were involved in the decisions that made that happen. So I think that's a really great reason to be here. But historically, there are a number of other things about this spot. It's a common, which with the technical meaning of which is slightly difficult to describe in short terms now, and is also slightly lost in sort of council legalese. But the main point of it is which there are a number of places left in London and around the country which are still called commons, and they're left over from a time from before the enclosures, and it meant that the commoners, the people of the area, had a right to use them, and mainly that was a right to graze their animals and to take fuel wood from there. But the point for us that's important is it was a place of public access that was communally owned, that although there might have been a technical ownership of the land, that people had real rights to use it, to assemble there, and to use it for their self-sufficiency and their sustainability. And at a time when so much of the planet and the climate is being privatized by capitalism, it's really important to remember concepts like the commons, and that there was a massively strong mode of being, if you like, for people throughout London, or what is now London, and the country, and it was only destroyed by enclosures and the privatisation of land that happened over a few centuries. And, you know, I think for a lot of us, we want to go back to a time where things like the atmosphere and the land is held in common, where people don't have the right to destroy it because it's there for everyone. It's there to be communally used as long as it's used responsibly. And that was a system that worked for hundreds and hundreds of years, much longer, in fact, than capitalism in its present form will survive. And it's hopefully a form that we can go back to, although obviously that depends on people getting together to organise to make it happen. Some of the other reasons why we're here is because of the its role it's had in the rebellions of various people at various times. Most famously, you mentioned the Peasants' Revolt in 1381, which was led by Wat Tyler, where the preacher John Ball spoke. He was a Lollard who was, they were sort of, well, I suppose slightly anti-establishment Christians. You know, now looking back, you wouldn't say there was anything particularly radical about them, but at the time, incredibly radical, talking about the class nature of society and the establishment institutions like the church and the power they had over people and the rights of people to organise and to have a share in the wealth. And the Peasants' Revolt, although I'm not an expert, you know, as many of these rebellions were, was about people being unhappy with the laws of the land and the taxes that were being demanded of them, and they mobilised in their thousands. The numbers are fairly well disputed, and you'll find numerous different figures for the numbers of people that were here then, but probably in their tens of thousands, they came here to demand a change in the system of taxation, and they met the king, and I think they didn't, I'm not sure if they actually met on the Heath. It may have been they met a bit more centrally into London, but here's where they were based. And Wat Tyler and others went down to meet the king, and of course they were promised various things because they were a dangerous and strong force of many thousands, and the short version of the long story is that Wat Tyler was murdered by the king's knights, and the demands that they had been promised they went back on and refused them because the peasants sort of disbanded and agreed to go away happy with the demands. They didn't actually stay to make sure they happened, if you like. I think there's a lot of lessons there about, you know, not trusting those in authority and power to give you what you want, but you have to make sure it happens before you before you agree to go away. And you can see why the Peasants' Revolt might have assembled here. It's an amazing position overlooking London. And at that time, 500 years ago, well, more than that, 700 years ago, it would have been much wilder, probably much larger, much more shrubbery, much more cover. It was a fairly dangerous place. Later on in the 16th and 17th, well, 17th and 18th centuries, it was a renowned haunt of various highwaymen. I think Jack Turpin amongst them used to hang out here and hold up various stagecoaches on the way to Kent and Dover. And I think some people like that that analogy of the reappropriating wealth from the rich and giving it over to some poorer people, whether you agree with that way of doing it or not. A longer debate, probably. But it has that tradition. It also has a tradition of various marches and rallies happening here from the suffragettes at the turn of the century and also following that time, I think in the tens and twenties of this century, or rather last century. There were various political rallies here, it's a big open space, and still now there are fairs here. I mean, there's one happening here at the moment, which is really the modern version of the old medieval fairs, which were one of the main meeting grounds for people in medieval times and after that, for where people had a chance to get out of the area to go and trade their goods, to find husbands and wives, get out of their village, performed a very important social function. Those fairs still continue here, and I think there's a lot to be said about the way the community has been ruined by modern capitalism, and, you know, and how the Camp for Climate Action is an attempt at forming a bit of a different community, and in a way those fairs were a sort of different community, and hopefully we're sort of taking some of those aspects of that when we assemble as well. I mean, that's not all about the Heath. There was another famous rebellion in the 1450s by Jack Cade, a load of Kentish peasants, again protesting about taxation and government laws. Thousands of mainly men, one presumes, here, but maybe not, I don't know. They always talk about men, yeah, I don't really know. We're here, camped out above London, making various demands. We're quite a strong force. Unfortunately, we're again deceived, and many of the leaders were murdered by the state. Hopefully that's not an outcome that awaits the people at the climate camp. Hopefully things have moved on a bit, who knows. I think lastly, one of the reasons why this is an interesting place to be is because we're just at Greenwich. We're virtually on the line of the meridian. Greenwich, as maybe people know, is the sort of point zero of the time bands that go around the world. So sort of time and distance, if you like, are measured from zero at Greenwich. So it has quite a symbolic element about thinking about what sort of times we're living in and how we want to relate to the rest of the world, because that creation of time originally was a very important part of colonialism and the imperialism that did so much damage around the world, because people created the sort of navigational skills and the understanding that enabled them to go to so many places safely and trade and steal and pillage. But here at a sort of point zero of time is also a time for us to think about what sort of world we want to create, whether we want to have that sort of relationship with the rest of the world, or whether it should be one based more in equity and sharing and mutual aid, and you know, what sort of transport we should have with the rest of the world, Britain's role in international relations, and how we might perceive of time in the future, and whether it's, you know, on more abstract terms, whether it's the same sort of linear progress that for so long people have believed in, or whether we need to go to back to a more holistic vision of time that sees things more in terms of seasons and nature, and not in terms of us not in terms of us progressing to an infinitely greater level based mainly on theft and destruction of other people's. So, I mean, there's a lot there, and that's only a brief resume of the situation, but I think that combination of things is very potent, and it gives us a lot to think about when we're here on the heath overlooking London, and wondering which way our society will turn as it deals with the many crises that affect it.
As you just mentioned now, there are more holistic and different ways of community organizing, more sustainable and ecological. And you're involved in some projects like that. Would you like to tell us about some of them?
I'm involved in a couple of projects that are about land use. One is a permaculture project called Land Matters, who own a 40-acre site in Devon that we bought 5-6 years ago. There's a dozen people there living with their families, and in a fairly low impact way. And I mean, that's about many things, but particularly about trying to design a piece of land around the principles of permaculture, trying to raise the children in a more constructive and long-term way than I think people feel is often possible in a city or in a state education. It's about growing food and being self-reliant as much as possible. It's about holding courses there for people to come and learn about all sorts of, everything, sustainable building, holistic health, active, various facets of activism, woodland management, all sorts of things. It's a very beautiful site. We're very lucky to have it. And there's one of a network now, really, of many groups of people around the country who've bought land at various times and who are living there in an attempt to sort of live out their ideas that things could be organised slightly differently and we could be a lot more self-reliant as people, and that could actually make us happier rather than meaning that we have to do without various things. And, you know, I think although life is quite hard in some ways in those communities, and there's always, of course, lots of issues there, they are, you know, amazing examples that it is possible. And if you're willing to sacrifice some things, maybe in terms of unlimited electricity and, you know, immediate mobility, but you gain in terms of security and community and connection to a place, and the happiness of knowing that you're not so engaged in a capitalist system that's sort of causing such horrific destruction all around the world. and there's many out there, and people can look in books like Diggers and Dreamers, or contact networks like Radical Roots, or Chapter 7, who offer a sort of advice service to people interested in planning issues around getting onto land and managing land, or, you know, pursue various things in a search engine around low impact development, or LAMAS, who are out in Wales, who just this week, in fact, have got planning permission for their proposal for an eco village in Pembrokeshire, and which is a really landmark moment, because that's the first permission for an eco village in those terms, and the inspector has given a really good judgment that allows those people to go ahead and build their homes and make their living there. So, you know, things are moving in the right direction, although obviously too slowly as usual. The other thing I'm involved in is a company called the Ecological Land Co-op, which is attempting to use ethical investment money to buy land to support people on lower incomes getting access to land and to set up small holdings or ecological projects, and we're just in the middle of our sort of first project at the moment with a site in Devon, which we'll be hoping to offer to probably about 3 families sometime next year, with a leasehold for a sort of 7-acre site with planning permission. And there are a number of challenges involved in that, to do with planning and to do with management of the land, but it's essential that we see a land resettlement program in this country, that we see people getting closer to nature again and out of some of the mechanistic ways of living that we develop when we live in the city. It's essential that we start growing more of our own food, that we prove that it's possible to survive in a much more self-sufficient way, and hopefully that's part of that. And there are more and more of these groups all around the country who are trying to get access to land, although unfortunately land remains very expensive and the planning laws remain very much against people moving on to land, but, you know, there are changes and it's possibly going in the right direction. Let's hope so.
Great. Well, thank you so much. That was such a vast amount of information compacted. People aren't alone if they have this impetus to go out and try and live a more sustainable and community-based lifestyle. Like, and it's not just a lifestyle, it's so much more than that. There's such a vast amount of history and politics behind it. But thank you very, very much for talking to us. And hopefully people will come to your workshop and learn even more, because you're doing a workshop today on
Land projects and eco-villages. And this afternoon.
And how has your camp experience been so far?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? It's really inspiring to be here and be part of what must be the largest event of a community living under anarchist principles that the country sees from year to year. And, you know, it's a self-sustaining system that I don't know how long we could all last here, but for a week anyway, it's really amazing to be part of, just to see every day that people are on the case with cooking and the toilets and, you know, being on the gate, you know, and there's no one in charge. You know, it really is, there's a process for people to get involved in, and there's lots of space to do things. And I think obviously there are various challenges, like there always are, but it's an amazing example of community life, and hopefully it's inspiring enough for people to want to go on to do more things like this, to have more camps in other parts of the country, and to take more action against climate change and the corporations that are causing it.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Hello. I'm here on the ground at RBS. I'm sitting up a ladder with 2 other people from the ladders, and all the rest aren't cheered and locked on as well. There are 6 people inside who managed to get up to the second floor and superglued themselves on. We're not sure exactly what's happened because we can't hear back. And all that we know is from security guards. Climate camp turned up about 2 hours after we got here. It was amazing. We rocked up kind of Liverpool Street Station. There were about 2 or 3 police vans, several police cars, lots of cops walking around, and we managed to set up in 30 seconds without any hassle at all. We've now blocked all the bankers from going in and out of the bank, and hopefully we've shut it down for an ethical renovation. RBS is one of the biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry, And after the government bailing them out, we now own 70% of the bank. So basically, we're here to reclaim the space and say that we want all of our money to be spent in a way that's going to benefit us and not destroy our future. Bye.
Oh, great. We're back. And I'm sitting here with Theo and Beth, and they're going to play us a song.
This is a song. Well, I mean, I'm just learning the accordion, so there's a disclaimer to start with. But this is a song by Michelangelo and the Black Sea Gentlemen, and it's been a bit of a campfire favourite, so it seems appropriate. And Theo's actually playing a violin, it's a bit of a bespoke violin with a bridge made out of a piece of wood that we found by a river in France. So forgive him if it goes a bit out of tune halfway through.
Okay.
I have seen you in a Turkish bath. I didn't know whether to cry or laugh. Nakedness has a sweet, sweet smell. It sends me down to the depths of hell. The steam that rises from your skin makes me feel like Satan's kin. And if you're another fallen one, then into the darkness we should run. Cause sodomy is not just for animals and human flesh. It's not just for cannibals. I'll feast on your body if you'll feast on mine. Blood is thicker and redder than wine. Lay ourselves out upon the table. Ravish each other till we're no longer able. When juices mix in the heat of the fray, it will make a formidable marinade. Put your hand in Pandora's box, and you were smitten by a deadly pox. If you were a leper or you had swine flu, I'd still have an appetite for you. I'd spit roast you like a fatted calf, and then I'd split your body in half. I'd climb into your reddened core, curl up tight and close the door. Cause sodomy is not just for animals and human flesh. It's not just for cannibals. I'll feast on your body if you'll feast on mine. Blood is thicker and redder than wine. Lay ourselves out upon the table. Ravish each other till we're no longer able. When juices mix in the heat of the fray, it will make a formidable marinade. Maybe wasn't very popular with the vegans on site. Sorry about that.
Still a quality tune, though, all the same.
Definitely. And Theo, you're going to play us a tune as well?
That's right, yeah. I would like to play you a tune, which was, it was a bit of a slow burner for a long time. I only started performing it quite recently. I actually performed it for the first time at Climate Camp in the City at the G20. Mm-hmm. And really enjoyed doing that. And I was one of the Drax 29, which I'm very proud of. And that's like the compulsory response here at Climate Camp, isn't it? This song is kind of an attempt to inspire people to do similar things, which is obviously what Climate Camp is all about. So it seems like the right thing to sing right now. Can you take a patch of wasteland and plant roses oh so sweet? Can you take a crying baby and rock him to his sleep? Can you feed a hungry child, give a stranger your smile, or when seeing someone riled, make their anger meek and mild? Well then you could make a difference to this fickle world of change. Can you fell a giant oak tree, or plant one from a seed? Can you cut into living flesh? Could you stop a wound that bleeds? Cure an illness when it's rife? Marry husband into wife? Or with surgeon's sharpened knife, could you save a person's life? Well then you could make a difference in this fickle world of change. Have you ever lost your road, wandering aimless here and there? Have you ever been alone? Has a stranger taken care? Have you been so far from home, when like water from a stone, foreign friendship starts to grow, and all your loneliness is flown? Then you know what makes a difference in this fickle world of change. Can you keep your conscience clean without hands as black as coal? Can you focus on your task, trying to realize your goal? If you make all your demands as you stand on sinking sands and nobody understands as they cast you to the damned, then you try to make a difference to this fickle world of change. Can you stand up and be counted as a body in a crowd? Put your name on a petition with your signature so proud. Can you raise your voice so loud as you stand with head unbowed, weather beating on your brow, demanding answers here and now? 'Cause that's how you make a difference in this fickle world of change. Do you see the breeze a-blowing? Can you feel the winds have changed? Do you smell the scent of roses, or does rotten air remain? Do you feel the time has come when we rectify what's wrong, putting all where it belongs as we stand up and be strong? 'Cause it's time to make a difference in this fickle world of change.
That was lovely, thank you so much. What was that song called?
It's actually not really titled yet. I'm afraid.
That's good. That's just me. I'm just sort of shifting around slightly for our next guest. But Theo, thank you so much for coming in, man.
And yeah. Thanks to Beth as well for that amazing
yes,
song.
Beth, you rule. Quality song. So we've got Richard from Camp Media who's here.
Hello.
Try that again.
Hello.
There we go. And we've also got two folks in from an action that happened today at the Daily Mail. Yay! So they're going to tell us about it. But first, we're going to talk to Richard from the media team. So tell us, what's been going on today out there?
Well, we've had a whole host of actions, and it all came off even better than we hoped. And a lot of people from people on first time actions kind of who came to the camp, got trained up and have then kind of gone out and done stuff. Our kind of glory Uplam Glory moment has been the Royal Bank of Scotland action. Like, that's got lots of good pickup in the press and so on. It's in the Evening Standard and in, like, the Free London Papers and so on, which isn't the be-all and end-all, but it's nice to know that someone's listening, even if it is the corporate press. Yep, and so there was a group of kind of many young activists kind of blockaded the Royal Bank of Scotland, blockaded the front entrance, locking themselves on using arm tubes and chains and so on. And some of them got in beforehand, dressed as construction workers, and glued themselves to, on, or in the trading floor. That was a great deal of confusion. At first, we kept getting reports saying they're glued to the floor, and we were like, what? Okay, and we were telling people they glued to the floor, and then we kind of found out it was like on the trading floor, and we're still not entirely sure, but we think they were actually glued to themselves. What was really great about that is they blockaded the front, but there was still a side exit which like workers could go in and out of. But then the rambling, what was it called? The rambling rebellion, raffle, rambling, yeah, raffle of rebellion, resistance, or resistance, that, yeah, was it. Turned up. Which basically meant kind of like a group of, like a small riot turned up and kind of rushed the side exit. And after they had done that, the one security guard that RBS had like posted that side exit got a bit scared, and a whole load of police went in there, which meant that the small riot got kind of pushed back. But it also meant they closed that side exit, which meant they closed down the RBS headquarters, which was really nice. And it was kind of like, in a nice little manner, RBS and the police and the protesters all kind of work together to bring this about. That's what we like to see, like a proper dialogue unity between police and protesters in shutting things down. So that was good. And then there was really great action just after that at Edelman PR. And it's really good who have got Eon's account.
Okay.
So it was really good, like targeting greenwash in this really specific way. And the way they did it is by kind of, with this really nice pun of like exposing the naked truth. And so it was seven naked protesters with a banner actually inside the offices and so on, behind the glass doors. And lo and behold, the rambling raffle riot of resistance turned up there as well, which was really great. And they turned up there and made a bit of a fuss, and Edelman got really kind of scared and ran away a bit, because they had been saying, oh, we'll kind of, you know, we can talk to you and we'll have a discussion. And then the small riot turned up and they said, we're not discussing things. So that's really good. And then the riot went on, and they went to BP and they joined in with the Canadian activists who are campaigning about the destruction of the tar sands in Alberta. And these guys are doing a really good march around, like, starting Trafalgar Square, going to National Portrait Gallery, which is sponsored by British Petroleum and so on, then Canadian Embassy, and then the headquarters of BP. And then the riot caught up with them, and then they moved on to Shell. And, like, I think, like, in a really nice little way, ending it off, someone nicked the S from the big Shell sign at their Waterloo headquarters, so it just said Hell. And the police kind of made an announcement to the crowd, apparently, saying, can you please give us back the S? And they said no. Which was, again, like, we, you know, it's good that we have a dialogue going with the police. Where we can say no. And the final little thing, which hasn't got much pickup, but I think it's a really nice little genuine piece of direct action, is some folks, we're not quite sure who, went and blocked up all of the whole load of toilets at London City Airport, which meant that they got disrupted and they had to, they were thinking of shutting down for a bit, and they disrupted some flights. So that's a genuine cut in emissions just by sticking some stuff down a loo.
Excellent. Wow, that is fantastic. It looks like it's been an excellent jam-packed day, and we actually have some people here who are on another action at the Daily Mail. So could tell us about it and introduce yourselves and tell us what you got up to today. And
Well, my name's Nade.
I'm Emma.
And I'm Harry.
And, well, we went down just to the Daily Mail building just because I guess, you know, Daily Mail, hate them.
Yeah, we had a really good mixed group of activists. We had, like quite a few women, some queer activists, some, like, international comrades, and, like, some unemployed people. So we had a lot of reasons to want to go and upset the Daily Mail and, like, scare them a little bit.
And also, like, you know, they, I guess they'd said in the paper recently that people at climate camp were just young, posh idiots. Yeah. Don't mind young, don't mind idiot. But, you know, we were there to show that maybe we weren't all posh, you know.
An idiot.
Yeah.
So what did you get up to then? Well, while you were there, you went down to the building and, like...
Well, we sort of stormed our way in, didn't we?
Yeah,
Emma?
We didn't, what was we didn't get that far in. There were a lot of coppers waiting for us.
Yeah, sort of masked up around the corner, then ran around chanting.
Yeah.
Gave it a good go.
We got quite a lot of good support from people just passing by on the street. We got quite a few people taking photos. What was that one guy saying? Oh, well, they have got the point. It is the Daily Mail.
Well, yeah. We sort of, you know, rocked with the security through the sort of the doors and everything, these sort of passers-by sort of sat there, you know, arms crossed, sort of saying, well, it is the Daily Mail, isn't it? You know, sort of maybe leave off them a bit. They're kind of shit, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has some mediators as well from just walking by. Yeah. Just like, calm down, they're all right, you know, let them in anyway.
Yeah, and we weren't trying to go and look very, like, fluffy and nice, so that was really, really good.
So, any future direct action targets that you want to warn on the radio, you'll be coming for them?
Guardian, we're coming for you, you bastards.
Throw something in there. Well, it wasn't me, but someone might have passed on some information. Like, we did text the riot. Unfortunately, the small riot had kind of started to die down, about the fact that while we were, like, doing some kind of kick-ass actions and so on, the Guardian were, in collaboration with the Age of Stupid, were putting on cocktails and champagne in Tate Modern for businesses and corporations as part of their 10-10 campaign to reduce carbon for businesses to reduce carbon emissions by 10% by 2010. And they'd, like, told us about this morning, say, like, hey, we know you're doing loads of stuff, but hey, do you want to come along to this too? Like, maybe some of you guys in the media team want to have a glass of champagne.
If we'd heard about that, we'd have been there in a flash.
Yeah, like, we sent a couple of texts, but, like, it started to disband. But what's even grosser is they invited Eon along.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So, yeah, just say, like, The Guardian are not entirely in our good books right now.
So, we would have loved to be there, but we were getting quite hassled. We got some police make some very, like, xenophobic statements and...
We left these sort of suited and booted sort of toffs and journos looking a little bit shocking awed. So we took off, but we got a bit of a good old run around by armed police through Hyde Park, you know.
Oh yeah, he did threaten one of us by saying, like, oh, you want to stand back a bit, we are armed. Call, like, tactical support as well.
They're the ones who came originally, you know, they drove round as, like, popped out their little red cars.
Well, we've got a jam-packed show tonight, so I'm going to have to cut you off here, but thank you so much for coming in and telling us about it. Yeah, well done. Big up yourselves, man.
Let's plug our groups.
And we're going to hear from Derek on Anti-Capitalism.
Chickpea here with Climate Camp Radio 2009, and I'm sitting here with...
So I'm Derek Wall. I'm a kind of economist. I used to be Green Party speaker, and I'm an anti-capitalist because capitalism's destroying the planet. I've got a bias against it because of that.
Okay, so, well, you've just told us why you're an anti-capitalist, but a lot of people have just... accepted the fact that capitalism is here and it's never going to go away. What would you say to people in the outside world looking at us climate campers and thinking, shaking their heads, thinking, who are these people? What alternative is there? What is the alternative to capitalism, I suppose?
I think if people come here, what's great is the way that people can self-organise. It's much more organised, in fact, here than the rest of the world. So if it's anti-capitalist, anti-capitalism works. What we mean by capitalism is this system where we've got to produce more, consume more, work more forever and ever, because everything is based on profit. And the problem with that, the one really big problem, is it doesn't work, because if you consume more and more forever and ever, you wreck the planet. And you exploit people. So the alternative to me is based on this whole idea of the commons. And the commons is the idea that you can have what's called common pool property, people can get access to property. Good examples, really big topic, but if you look at things like the internet and free software, that's commons. If you look at land patterns that indigenous people have, that's commons. So what we can basically do is have an economy where... we make goods to last longer, We share more goods like carpools. You have more libraries for things. So we can actually have a lot more access to stuff without having to extract stuff out of the ground. And the great thing about that is we wouldn't need to work as much. So we're in this sort of obsessive, it's like we're all heroin addicts, although I think it's easier to get off heroin, but we've got this system where people are going to work harder, consume harder, chuck stuff more away, or else you get recession and collapse. I know it looks like the only way of doing things. The problem with it is if we use more and more ever and ever of stuff, we're going to run out of the world. And we've got the problem with carbon and energy, but the very fact that we need more and more stuff, chucking it away, there's more mines, those are going into rainforests, and we need those forests to maintain basic ecological systems. So the reason I come to the camp is, I look at 99% of the efforts to change, to deal with climate change, and they're based on carbon trading, they make the banks rich. Did you know there's a $160 billion market in carbon trading? So what's really crazy is John Prescott saying how wonderful the climate camp is. He's a fucking idiot. He and his government have put like the bankers in charge. So it's like the bankers have completely wrecked the economy and they're in charge of climate. I digress anyway.
Another criticism of anti-capitalism is that we're going to end up with this extremely frugal, stripped-down lifestyle where people can't fulfill their desires, can't...
Well, no, because if you think about it, if you've got goods that last longer, then you've got more prosperity and more access to stuff, but the capitalists make less money. So there are rational ways of running things. I mean, you know, I always say to people, although it's not perfect, a good model of this is Waitrose. Yeah, you know, there's also things wrong with Waitrose, but it's like communism, because basically all the workers share the profit. So it's about clever design. We've got like a stupid economy that only works if we waste stuff. We can cleverly design an economy where we can have actually access to things we need with less waste, less overconsumption, because they last longer, more libraries for things. I think people should fly less, because I really love flying, and I would fly everywhere, and I do find a bit of a sacrifice not flying, so I haven't quite cracked that one. But, you know, the economy is not based at the moment on what's good for people. It's based on what's good for short-term profit. It's a kind of zombie economy. It would take hours to really talk about the design, but what I would recommend is people look. There's a great document called Whose Common Future, which is free, on the Corner House website. That's a good start.
Why hasn't our economic system evolved into something that is sustainable and is a long-term thing that we can live with?
I think in parts of the world, if you look at indigenous people, they've got ways of maintaining land and rainforests that work. And I think it's a bit like trial and error. And, you know, the sort of greediest people and the people who are most addicted, I suspect, sort of run it all, and we've had this evolution of capitalism. I think what's going to happen is, because it doesn't work, we will tend to evolve other things, but we can't leave it to the evolution. We've got to have the social struggle for it. And what is great about Climate Camp is Climate Camp is saying capitalism just doesn't work. You know, we all know this. And Climate Camp is one of the places where people are brave enough to say that. And we know all in our hearts and hearts that if we waste more, produce more, consume more, that doesn't work. You know, it's going to wreck the environment, it's no fun, it exploits workers. But there are ways in which that we can be prosperous, yeah, design a new economy. But we won't get it just by wishing for it. We got to struggle for it. So it's all about enclosures. People want to enclose the internet and make us pay for music. There's a rebellion against that. People want to take the rainforests and mine the oil in Peru. There's a rebellion against that. There's lovely open space like Blackheath. We've got to defend that. So the struggle continues.
Well, any way that people can find what you talk about and write on the internet or online or somewhere?
Well, you can have a look at my blog, Another Green World. Lucha Indigena, if you read Spanish, which is the Indigenous Struggle magazine, is just brilliant. Corner House is very good. Loads of resources. I think Marxism is very, very important. So have a look at the Marxist Internet Archive. Marx knew about the indigenous and common poor property rights. And rather astonishingly, Marx was really interested in ecology, but all the left forgot this. So go and, you know, look at his lovely book just out, is John Bellamy Foster's The Ecological Revolution. But it's not enough to read the stuff. We've got to get politically organised and struggle and change things and do it damn quickly, which is what I'm about.
So this morning, seven of us ran through the revolving doors, jumped the fence and up the escalators while another nine were training themselves to the entrance and putting banners up. We kept running up these escalators, noticed security hadn't found us yet, went up another floor, went up to the offices, thought we'd give it a go, put in the office door open, and it opened. Ran in, looking for something to lock onto, no table legs, no anything like that, but we saw a TV stand. So one of us got their arm through that, and we all glued ourselves onto each other and sat down. Started chanting and ranting at everyone in the office, got pretty much everybody there to come over and see what was going on, including a couple who actually asked us some questions that we managed to answer. And then over the next half hour or so, lots more people came into the room and surprised to find us there, all glued together and chanting and ranting at everyone. In the end, the police came along after about 2 hours of us being there and creating quite a lot of disturbance and also inspiration in people. I think a lot of people learnt a lot in the office. And eventually, the removal team came along and took us out. And we were arrested and then offered to be de-arrested and offered a court summons. And weren't taken to a cell or anything, which is fantastic. Except one of us, there was a misunderstanding with, or a complication with where, if he has an address that he resides at, he's been taken in. But essentially, we all got off until the court hearing. So this morning, seven of us ran through the revolving doors, jumped the fence and up the escalators while another nine were training themselves to the entrance and putting banners up. We kept running up these escalators, noticed security hadn't found us yet, went up another floor, went up to the offices, thought we'd give it a go, put in the office door open, and it opened. Ran in, looking for something to lock onto, no table legs, no anything like that, but we saw a TV stand. One of us got their arm through that and we all glued ourselves onto each other and sat down. Started chanting and ranting at everyone in the office, got pretty much everybody there to come over and see what was going on, including a couple who actually asked us some questions that we managed to answer. And then over the next half hour or so, lots more people came into the room and surprised to find us there, all glued together and chanting and ranting at everyone. In the end, the police came along after about 2 hours of us being there and creating quite a lot of disturbance and also inspiration in people. I think a lot of people learnt a lot in the office. The removal team came along and took us out. We were arrested and then offered to be de-arrested and offered a court summons. And weren't taken to a cell or anything, which is fantastic. Except one of us, there was a misunderstanding with or a complication with where, if he has an address that he resides at, he's been taken in. But essentially, we all got off until the court hearing.
And yeah, now we're back again. And I'm sitting here with Paul Marazzo, who is going to be talking to us about the Where Next for Climate Camp, which has actually been the theme of today's workshop. It hasn't been a workshop at all. It's actually been an open meeting where everyone has come together in the camp. Give us some information about what is being talked about in regards to Climate Camp. What is going to happen next for Climate Camp?
Well, the day comprised of three parts. Firstly, there was a kind of introduction which laid out where the camp had come from and the camp's origins, and then there was a look at the achievements, and then there was a session on where people went into their kind of criticisms of the camp. But that sounds quite negative, but we're activists and campaigners, so criticism is an ongoing part of what we do. You know, you can't move forward and develop unless you critique and develop ideas. So that was and it was actually a really brilliant part of the day. I think often movements and groups get really uptight about dealing with criticism, but this was an open session where everyone kind of got a bit of time to say, right, okay, this is what hasn't been working for me, and this is how we could improve it. So that was that. And then in the afternoon, we took all that and built up a kind of a kind of a series of visions and ideas about how we could move forward, basically. And, you know, it's an incredibly complicated process. There's lots of different people, lots of different views, even different kind of politics. So getting to any kind of agreement certainly wasn't possible in the time we had. But I think what we did was we opened up the main areas of debate, basically. And
what are some of the people saying in these meetings in regards critiquing the camp? Can you tell us about some of the self-reflection that's happened?
I don't remember the whole meeting. It was a five-hour meeting, so I'm obviously going to give you a partial view. But the things I remember from the meeting, the main areas of criticism were basically around the idea of whether we identify as anti-capitalist or not. There was a lot of talk about diversity, and there was quite a lot of talk about how our process works, and there was some talk about the nature of our direct actions, whether they're too symbolic, whether we're slipping towards doing kind of stunts and demonstrations more than actions, and there was some criticism about the way we deal with the media. So those are the main areas that I can remember.
Do you mind me asking, were the camp's main aims discussed? Because there's always been four aims of the camp, were they reflected upon?
Yeah, I actually gave a kind of summary of the main aims at the beginning and where they'd come from, why we'd come up with those originally.
And can you just refresh our memories of what they are?
The way I put it was, I said there'd been three main kind of aims in the beginning, and those were movement building. Now I'm going to forget, aren't I?
Check. You've done that.
Check. Movement building. The other one was creating a physical space for resistance. And the final one was creating symbolic and real moments of antagonism. And then those were kind of crystallized down to these four areas for the camp, which were movement building again, education, direct action, and remind me what the third one is.
Sustainable living.
That's it. And so I went into why those things had come about, and also obviously said, you know, that's the past, we're here now, and everyone in this room is now the camp, so let's not get hung up on the past, but that's where we come from. And Robin gave a brilliant summary of the more distant past and how it led to some of the ways we organised the, for instance, all the stuff that happened in against some of the G8 mobilisations.
Sterling, of course, is legendary.
Sterling and all the horizontal, the way they had camps that were organised in a similar way along a neighbourhood basis and all that kind of thing.
Cool. And just, I mean, this was quite a long and arduous conversation to have, you know, sort of working out where the camp's going to go forward. And I suppose, I'm not saying that any decisions have been made, but did you think that the people who were there were leaning away from any areas, or there was more of a lean towards certain things, for instance? And also, I just want to bear in mind that the conversation today wasn't a huge portion of the camp, because a lot of people were out on actions.
Yeah, it was unfortunate. It was an unfortunate bit of scheduling. I think people just hadn't really noticed it's Bank Holiday Monday and hadn't predicted that the main day of action would be Tuesday, so there was a bit of a clash. But once it was, I think people basically felt they'd organised the meeting and they should just get on with it, and the people managed the actions, they did a brilliant job. So in a way both things happened, and so all good. What was the question?
I was asking whether there are any particular leans towards anything in relation to discussing aims, etc.
The main kind of areas were, should we concretize our anti-capitalism if we have it? Should we make it more explicit? So that's one area that people talked about a lot. That's the main one I can remember. I mean, obviously there's just loads, and there's a load of stuff about whether we should stop having national gatherings and we should do much more work, focus much more locally and regionally, so base ourselves on the neighbourhood structure a lot more. But what there wasn't, which hopefully will come later, is I suppose I felt like it's difficult to discuss a process when you don't know what your actual objective is and why you've, what your aims are and what you're about. And so until we've got those, I think it's going to be hard to really kind of clear up what our process is going to be.
So will this sort of conversation, just to wrap this up now, but like, will these conversations be continued at the next national gathering, for instance? Is this where people can go to get involved in shaping the future?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, at the national gathering. I mean, the national gathering is currently our decision-making forum. So yeah, that's the place to go. But I mean, I think there's going to be a broader discussion in the wider movement about where next, basically.
Cool. But of course, it's a process everyone should get involved in. It is everyone's camp.
That's right. Exactly. That's the whole idea.
I don't know.
I think it's the first weekend of October in Leeds.
Okay.
All right,
so,
cool.
Yeah, get on down there and become part of the process and make it your own camp. And, yeah, thank you very much, Paul.
Cool. Cheers, dude. I think we're going to go into a quick track.
Yeah.
Who's this by, dude?
The Interterrestrials.
Ah, yeah.
This next song is about the Newbury Reunion Rampage. When the trashing and burning of Middle Oak compound, they don't rock in like it up them, Middle Oak.
Sitting here with Pete the Temp.
And hello.
How was your day today?
Oh, it was wonderful. We went to visit BP with the tar sands activists, and there was a huge load of us. And first, we went to the National Portrait Gallery, where BP is sponsoring an art exhibition there, and then we walked around to the Canadian Embassy. And then we finally ended up at the BP head office. And it was a fantastic explosion of colour and noise and energy and people giving their perspectives on BP and their experience on BP from all the way around the world. The tar sands activists have just stood out as just amazing, amazingly well spoken, and articulate in getting their message across. They're really, really good. And what is so fantastic about this climate camp is that a week ago, pretty much nobody in this country knew anything about tar sands. Now there was a massive campaign, and there were best part of 200 people outside BP, BBC cameras filming all of this, and it was great. So jobs are good, and really, I mean, how quickly can you create an international campaign in one country, without climate camp? Long live.
Can you tell us about the issue then? What have you learned about tar sands?
Yeah, I mean, it's an area of hydrocarbons, oil specifically, bitumen, I think, in northeast Canada, and it's a size which is bigger than England. It's going to be huge. I mean, it's going to be second biggest oil deposit after Saudi Arabia. It's a very dirty fuel, and it's just the sheer scale of the things, you know, being dug up with vehicles which have, you know, 25-foot wheels. You know, I mean, just absolutely massive operation. And apart from the effects, the obvious effects of climate change and carbon emissions, you're going to have massive destruction to ancestral lands, displacement, and just environmental degradation. And they're really up against it. The Canadian government, from what I've learned over the last few days, is an absolute carbon whore, to excuse the expression. It's really not looking good for them. So they're mobilising an international campaign at the moment.
So I suppose one of the critiques of tar sands as a product, as it were, I suppose, is that it's actually not in any way carbon neutral to get out, because you mentioned the diggers with 25-foot wheels. It seems to be that they can only basically extract it if the oil is going to sell for an expensive enough price.
That's it, and it's just ridiculous investing in new fossil fuels like this. BP prides itself, you know, has this very well cultivated image, and the whole idea of sponsoring art exhibitions is so that it can improve its public image.
Total greenwash, dude.
But of course, it's still, you know, playing ahead with new fossil fuel developments in Canada, and this is what we have to make a song and a dance about. And it was beautiful. And then, then after BP, we went on to Shell, it was quite a spectacle. Somebody who shall remain nameless,
but deserves a pat on the back,
pulled down the S just to leave a hell centre, and it was just a beautiful crowning moment. And then people climbed up onto the top of their entrance, and it was all good, all very funny, all, you know, good atmosphere, jobs are good and really everyone felt quite empowered and quite spirited by the whole day's event. So there's a general feeling in the camp now of accomplishment, you know, as we're kind of drawing towards the end of the week. You know, we're really feeling that we've actually had within the camp some really good actions and some really good publicity from it as well.
In terms of being out on the actions, have you met many other like affinity groups, and have you managed to expand your own network, I suppose, by meeting people?
That's it. Yeah, I have done, not only from other parts of the country, but also within Thames Valley, which is where I'm from. Meeting other activists is really nice. Camping with them and socialising with them around the campfire has been great. Yeah, really invaluable.
Thames Valley's quite a nice little neighbourhood going on here, actually.
Oh yes.
Quality little kitchen, I notice.
And wonderful food. And yes, big up Thames Valley. Ooh. Massive.
Ah, yeah, no, great guys out there.
You do spoken word as well.
I am, yeah,
and I saw you being recorded on the TV, the Climate Camp TV.
Absolutely.
And I was like,
Yeah.
That was really fun.
My career. I'm a spoken word artist. Vision TV are great. I'm a spoken word artist, and that's kind of one of the main things I'm bringing to the camp, really, is my creativity. So today I was playing songs outside BP, and we've been doing lots of live poetry. Stand-up poetry is a really good art form for if you've got an axe to grind. You know, you can engage people not on an intellectual level as well as making them laugh, and it's a great art form for that. So last night around the campfire, there was loads of really amazing spoken word happening, and I've been doing that. I've been jumping around on stages and singing and dancing. It's been fun.
Fun.
Yeah.
I've got
one in my pocket. Shall I whip it out?
Yes, I think you should.
It's fresh. It's not. It's on a crumpled piece of paper because I wrote it this week.
Slightly better than the back of a fag packet, as they say.
Slightly better. I wrote it this week whilst I was just kind of assimilating all these amazing stimuli from around the festival of ideas and people and entertainment. And here we go. I mean, that's already too long an introduction. It's called well, I'm not going to give you the title because I don't want to mess up the poem for you. So I'm just going to launch into it. Just imagine you're not listening to the radio. What you're actually doing is you're watching the television. Close your eyes and see me talking to you on a television screen in your brain. Here we go. Dear supporters, my name is Tom Champagne, and I'm here to tell you about one of the gravest challenges facing civil society today. Across Britain, politicians and business leaders are scrabbling around to find solutions to the climate crisis. What's more, society is unable to tackle social problems and see to the needs of the disadvantaged. The government is apparently unable to stand up to corporate greed and unwilling to tackle injustice, social decay and neglect. The situation is made critical by widespread public apathy and disempowerment. The results will be climate chaos, increased inequality and chronic social decomposition. It's a cheery one, this. We believe that another world is possible, one that believes in social justice, one that believes in communities based on social inclusion, a world that works for the good of the many and not for the few. It's time to take action for change. That's why we're asking you to sponsor an activist today. Stanley Richman works in a cement works. He's been sponsoring one of our activists for 5 years. My sponsored activist is called Marrow. I chose him because he's got dreadlocks. This is a picture he sent me of himself de-locked to a coal-fired power station. These people are suffering persecution. We've got to help them. I think it's important that the little soap dodgers get the opportunity to have a bath. At the end of the day, I have the satisfaction in my heart that tonight, Marrow won't have to raid a skip round the back of Tesco's just to put food on his table. I used to worry about flying the family up to Malaga on holiday each summer. Thanks to support an activist, I can relax in the knowledge that an activist is doing my bit for me. Sponsor an activist is a registered charity case. We pride ourselves on keeping admin costs to a minimum, so your money gets to where it's needed. To the crusties. Set up a direct action, direct debit with sponsor an activist, and get a complimentary all private property is theft keyring. Just £5 a month could help build a compost toilet in a commune or a squat. £10 a month could help supply an activist with soya milk for 2 weeks. £15 a month could help pay for an eye operation for an activist who has been badly beaten by the police. Give an activist a carabiner and he can tie himself to a Harrier jump jet for a day. Give an activist a Harrier jump jet and he and his family can attack military installations for a generation. Activists don't want to live on handouts. They need the tools to work themselves out of poverty. We believe it's possible for these crusties to set up their own charities with their own fundraising departments which provide ethical office jobs for more middle-class white people. At the heart of Sponsor an Activist is the ethos of armchair activism, helping people who can't help them, who can't take direct action, take action. Because we believe that anti-capitalism begins in the home. You can make a difference. Together, we can overcome activist fatigue and create a world which is safe for activists to sabotage state power, deface corporations, and enact radical hands-on solutions that go beyond trying to change the world by giving a few pounds each month through your bank account. Thank you so much for your support. Deeply conceited satire there.
And thank you so much for
coming. You're welcome. My pleasure.
And we're going to listen to an interview that I did with Lynn Zoya on animal rights.
I should be here with Climate Camp Radio 2009, and I'm sitting here with
Lynn Zoya.
And tell us a bit about your background. What brings you to Climate Camp? What have you been doing?
I'm concerned about climate change, as is every reasonable human being. I'm concerned about what's happening to the environment. I'm also concerned about animal rights, human rights, and justice issues.
Okay, so you gave a workshop at Climate Camp this year, and it was in regards basically lessons to be learned from the current animal rights struggle in the UK and beyond. Why don't you tell us about that?
Okay, the workshop was centred around the formation of the National Extremism Tactical Coordination Unit based in Huntingdon, who set out in 2004 to dismantle the animal rights movement, to make the animal rights movement impotent with token protests. That was something that happened then, and since then we've seen people get double-figure prison sentences. We've seen people arrested for ridiculous things, such as holding a banner or handing out leaflets. We've also seen the police make many, many different arrests, unlawful arrests. The police trying to disrupt campaigning by, for example, going for addresses, trying to stop the post office hosting PO boxes, also British monomarchs. The court, you know, the role in the media and all of this, the demonisation of protesters, the word extremist being used a lot, as though it's dangerous, what we're doing is dangerous. To say that animals have rights is a dangerous thought. To say that climate change is something we should be fighting is a dangerous thought. It's an extreme thought, and that we should all just go along with whatever the government of the day is proposing.
So how does the government actually get away with putting people in jail for what seemingly, from at least potentially from the perspective of people here, very minor charges, very ridiculous things? Like how is that happening?
For example, in the case of one of my friends, in 2006, there were raids all over Herefordshire and Worcestershire. There's a small local campaign against the Kwani contract testing laboratory. Everybody was arrested under SOCPA, Serious Organised Crime and Police Act, Section 145, which make it an offence to try and make firm sever links with an animal research facility. And the penalty, if you're found guilty, is 5 years in prison. He got 4.5 years for holding a banner, for updating a website, for behaving in a manner. If he was on a demonstration, he would be one of the most fluffy protesters. He wouldn't threaten, he wouldn't even swear on a demonstration. He was incredibly law-abiding because that is the way he wanted to act. The fact that he was sent to prison for 4.5 years, his name's Sean Kirtley, it should be bringing shockwaves through every protester, because with SOCPA 145, 146, all the Secretary of State has to do, it doesn't have to go through Parliament, they can make that applicable to any protest at all in the country. For example, the nuclear industry, to say that anybody causing economic damage to a nuclear power station could be liable to 5 years in prison.
So in some sense, animal rights activists, protesters are being singled out. Yes. And very much criminalized. And you were saying earlier that you think this is going to reverberate through other movements, through other protest mm-hmm. movements, such as Climate Camp and other social justice movements. So can you expand upon that?
I think what we've seen in the last week at Climate Camp is very encouraging. I think that hopefully things are changing regarding the police since the G20 protests. If that's the case, maybe that won't happen. I mean, I haven't got a crystal ball. I don't know is the honest answer. But years ago, as we all discussed, you know, it was a very good discussion, which happened at the workshop yesterday, as we all discussed, the animal liberation movement were once the darlings of the media. We were all fantastic, etc. And eventually, over a period of time, that was no longer the case. And I think that people should be aware of the fact that it's not always going to be, oh, you're all wonderful people for fighting climate change. People do have to be aware of the possibility and prepare for that and learn from our mistakes, you know, work within affinity groups, support one another, etc. Support prisoners, that's incredibly important. And also, don't allow the state to divide up different groups. So if they're, you know, all your animal rights, therefore you're a criminal. You don't have to necessarily agree with every tactic used to say that 4.5 years in prison for somebody holding a banner is way over the top. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly important. And seeing here with certainly with FitWatch, making sure that we defend ourselves. Sometimes you have to go out. One of the things that's really important in this country, we are very lucky compared to other parts of the world where protesters get tortured and killed. You know, yes, some of us have died, but that is not the norm. If you're waiting for someone, you don't assume that they've been shot in the head. You know, you think they've probably gone out of bed late. Whereas in other countries, somebody doesn't turn up, you think they've been killed. So I think, but we do have to defend ourselves. We do have to realise that democracy and the freedoms that we've inherited, and yes, they're not perfect, we don't live in a free society, but those freedoms have been bought with the blood, the sweat and the deaths of lots of people through history.
Yeah.
And liberty sometimes comes with a cost. And if we're going to fight anything, we do have to protect ourselves, as the Climate Camp legal team is doing, as FitWatch have been doing, and that is very important. Sometimes realize, you know, complain about the police, don't take what they're giving you. If they're turning up with cameras, block them. That is very, very important. And to complain, and sue them. You know, I mean,
you've got the money and the time, right?
Well, I've sued the police successfully on 7 occasions to the tune of tens of thousands of pounds. So that was all legally aided, and I've got a job. So I think the thing is, if there's malicious prosecutions involved, if you've got repeated arrests, if what has been done to you is gratuitous, and then you can sue. And also, there are those who are on very low incomes who maybe can sue first of all, and then people can sue on the back of that. So to be aware of that, and to keep in touch with the legal teams, and I've learnt a lot from a legal workshop this morning, actually. One of the things I also really, really stressed in the workshop was the fact that with the Sequani raids and with subsequent other miscellaneous cases, people that never thought they'd ever get arrested have been arrested. We had a lady, a very lovely pensioner, who arrested, and the police knocked down her door one morning. She had no idea which solicitor to call. She had no idea about her rights. Everybody involved in activism needs to know the basics, that you go no comment and that you get legal advice pronto. Everybody needs to know that. Everyone needs to read briefings. And as we said, you know, I was bringing up this point, and somebody else said, you know, the Rampart invasion, when the police went into the ramparts. The people there were perhaps the people who thought, right, I don't want to get arrested, I don't want to go on the action, so I'll make the soup or the tea or the cake or whatever. If you're in the if you're here and you're working in the kitchen because you don't want to get arrested, you still might, you know, there are still up for not wishing to frighten people, to prepare people for that eventuality. And in general, you know, anyone could be arrested at any time for anything. It happens. And to be aware of your rights.
Yeah,
very, very important.
Very, very important.
So do you have any announcements or anything coming up in the future?
Yes, there's a demonstration against a rabbit farm in Lincolnshire who breed rabbits for experiments. And that's on the 26th of September, 12 o'clock. If anyone wants more details, if they look up a website, the SHAC website, it's www.shac.net. That gives all the information, and hopefully there'll be some transport from various parts of the country. But if they ring the number or email SHAC, then they can find out more about it. And if anyone wants to turn up, that'd be fantastic.
Great. And for people who do want to get involved with SHAC but don't necessarily have a direct
in through other people. How can people actually approach Shack? Is Shack open to new?
Very much so. There's a website, there's a phone number. Not just Shack, there's also the Sequani campaign, which is a small local campaign. There's a Wickham campaign. There are many, many different animal rights groups up and down the country. There's the Coalition Against the Fur Trade, the Vegan Society, Viva. There are many, many different animal rights organisations. And what we would say as well, a colleague of mine did another workshop on animal rights, and it's concerning the fact that we regard ourselves as superior to other species. And that's what's got us into this mess. We are important. Human rights are very important. Compassion for one another is very important. But at the end of the day, nothing makes us more important than any other animal. When you think about it logically, absolutely nothing. And we have to regard ourselves as custodians, and we have to regard ourselves as people around to clear up the mess, really. We're not here. The end of evolution is not us.
Yeah.
You know, we are part of the world, it's not here for us to use, we're just part of it. If we were to die out tomorrow, the world would still continue and continue evolving.
Great.
Yo.
Yeah, you listened to a nice full show at the Camp for Climate Action.
Value for Money show.
Yes. And we are Dissident Islands, let's make that clear.
Yeah, we rock.
Yeah, you should come visit our website and listen to our shows, because they're quite similar in some way.
Mm.
But, you know, we don't focus entirely on climate
camp.
We do other sort of coverage of activism and other issues as well.
And we did a workshop as well this week at the camp. But, of course, if anyone is interested in radio, give us a shout.
Yeah.
Love to meet up. We've got lots of projects on the go. Always room for people to help out, get involved, do things where you live as well, which is cool. Yeah.
Let's get some radical podcasting and radio frequencies out there up and running. It would be really cool.
The opportunities are there. We just need people who are interested.
Anyways, I've had a pretty good camp. It's not even over yet.
No, dude, we've got to take all this stuff down now.
Yeah, we do. Tap down. But it's been really fun.
Of course, we had some excellent music in here last week. We had some other spoken word as well. We've had some fantastic guests in. For myself, it's been a wicked experience all around. It's been such a positive, sounds very hippie-like, but it's been lots of love around the camp.
Yeah.
And it's been really important. I've noticed that without the hassle from the cops, we've actually been able to do the things that we want to do, as Paul talked about earlier, which is demonstrate sustainable living, education, and outreach, because in terms of any social movement, it's important to be able to reach out, and it's important to be able to talk to people, and the camp has succeeded very well this year in engaging. So I'm absolutely delighted by that, and I've also had loads of really good food, so
yeah,
that goes a long way to a good mood. So we're going to sign off now, so later, dudes.
You're listening to Dissident Radio. Be safe. Crossing the road.